Hey everyone, and welcome back to CDY Blackout, your home for music, movies, and a whole lot more. This is part one of our pre-Boscone coverage. If you don't know, Boscone's a great annual science fiction and fantasy book festival happening in Boston. It's happening February 15th through the 17th. You can go to Boscone, that's BOSKONE.org, for a whole lot more information. In this interview, I talked to author Clea Simon, who's a newcomer to Boscone, about the Boston music scene, which is a setting for her book, World Enough. She also shares a story behind her new mystery novels, most of which have animals as main characters, which I always love. Later on, I talked to Gerald Coleman, who has a resume that's just way too long to list here. We cover a lot of ground with this interview, talking about how theology and science fiction come together, his work with the Appalachian poets, and the diversity that we see and don't always see in comics and science fiction. As always, you can follow the show on Facebook under CDY Blackout, Twitter, Instagram under CDY Max, and don't forget, you can also become a Patreon follower. Supporting us is real easy. I've also got some new music to share. First up, after the interview with Clea, is Marco Bonvicini with Every Day, and later on, it's Kloger with Like a Stone. My next guest is another newcomer to the Boscone family. Author Clea Simon joins me over the phone. Clea, great to have you here, and I'm looking forward to meeting you face-to-face.
Thanks so much for having me.
No problem. And now you, we were actually talking about this earlier, you may actually be setting a record for the author who has to go the shortest distance for this thing, because you live in Somerville, so it's basically down the street, hop the train, and you're all set.
This is true, but as when we were talking before, as I pointed out, I do have to cross the Charles River.
That's right.
And as those of us who know anything about magic, crossing running water is significant. If nothing else, it will. I like to think it will cleanse me of any evil and make it safe for me to go over to Boscone.
Now I'm curious as to what got you first into going to like Boscone, like what happened that you became aware of it and decided you want to be a part of it.
Well, I've been aware of Boscone for years because I've among other authors and certainly among reader friends. I like to think all my friends are readers. I have many friends in the SF fantasy communities who've been attending for years. I hadn't thought of myself as Boscone material, even I've been very active in the crime fiction community for decades now, until it was a reader who pointed out to me that the fact that I have a lot of magic in my books. I have alternative universes. I have one series that's set sort of in a dystopian future city, that in fact I've been a part of this community for years. I just haven't been aware of it. So this is, I think to some extent, a homecoming. And of course, now that I've signed up for it, I'm realizing how many people I know, and I'm on several panels, and I'm looking forward to several panels, and I can't believe I haven't been going for years.
I kind of felt the same way, because I forget how I first learned about it. I think I just got like an email about it one day, because I'm on these different like email lists, and I thought, oh, this is a pretty cool thing. So I messaged them and, you know, said, could I get like a press pass? They said absolutely, and I've been going ever since. So it's been a ton of fun, and I cover a lot of comic cons and festivals. And the thing I like the most about Boscone is that it is a very chill vibe. It's there's really like no costumes. It's basically just talking to the authors. The panels are great. I think it's very, very well like organized. So this has become my like favorite thing to do.
Well, I'm very much looking forward to it. One of the things that interests me is that I feel like so many different facets of my life are participating in it. There's a big, actually, sort of a music scene, a creative component. And I used to be a music critic, and one of my novels set in the Boston rock world. And you know, I'm finding out like, oh my God, all these people I know from that world have been participating in Boscone, you know, since the 80s, if not earlier, you know, as well as the authors. And it does seem very, I want to say writerly and readerly, but also just sort of very creative, very world-creating centered, you know, very much devoted to the arts, I think, less than perhaps sort of maybe more pre-digested forms of fantasy or alternative worlds. I like that. It just seems it seems very interactive and smart, for lack of a better word.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, do you go to other cons, other book festivals?
Yes, I go to a lot of the crime fiction cons.
Oh, cool.
I mean, that's sort of been my standard thing. Is I usually go to BoucherCon, which is the biggest of the U.S. Cons and travels around every year. This year is going to be in Dallas. And I usually go to Malice Domestic, which is the Cozy Con, which is, you know, for sort of more traditional mysteries, which is in the spring in Bethesda, Maryland, every year. And, of course, we have our New England Crime Bake. And I think there's quite a lot of overlap.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. I go to a number of the different conventions, and I tend to see not a lot of the same faces, but a number of them. So, like, there's the people that I've met that will make the regular, like, con circuit. So they'll go to things like Boscone, Boston Comic-Con, Ireland Comic-Con, number of them, because it's a really good place to sort of, yeah, like, you know, get yourself out there and meet, like, the new fans.
Yeah. Yeah, I am looking at some of the other cons. This is sort of my first, this is my toe in the water.
Now, when you go to these conventions, because I read a lot of, like, articles about, you know, how to actually prep for a con, how to, like, make sure you can, like, get through it. What's your method for basically making sure that by, like the third day, you're not a complete zombie?
Well, I'm lucky in this case, and I'm not staying in a convention hotel. When I do stay at a convention hotel, usually my number one rule is leave the hotel at some point, get some air. I find that that's very important. And, you know, take breaks when you have to. It's so tempting to just do everything all the time, and, you know, and then stay at the hotel bar until, you know, until you drop. And yeah, and not only are you a zombie, but you come home with a cold. This is one of the reasons I'm having my cold now. I just want to get it over with.
Yeah. Get it done.
Yeah. For me, preparing for this one, I'm on a couple of panels, and I'm also moderating a couple of panels. So what I'm trying to do is read at least some of the works of the people whose panels I'm moderating. So that's really fun for me, because it's letting me know in advance what to expect, and I hope it'll make me a better moderator. Mm. For the average person, I don't know if it makes sense to read in advance, because you're going to find so many people who you want to read once you're there. But that's what I'm doing. But in general rule of thumb, I'd say leave the hotel, even if it's like for 5 minutes. Just go out and get some fresh air. It'll keep you sane.
And the nice thing is, you know where all the cool spots are. You know, like, exactly where to go. You know, the bars to go to, the restaurants, or where to just, like, walk around and see the sights.
Yeah, really. If you see me in the hallway, just grab me, and we'll go out. We'll get a coffee. At the very least, we'll walk down to the water, because we're right near the water there.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. You know, you walk down, like, South Station. There's so many good places to go out there. Of course,
don't even have to go down to South Station. Just walk over towards the ICA, and there's this beautiful deck, and you can just, you know, without going into the museum. The museum's really fun too if you need a break. But you can just sit out on the deck and watch the boats go by. And,
yeah.
You know, there's what's better for your soul than that?
Exactly, exactly. Well, you know, you sound like a person who will be a lot of fun at a show, because you mentioned that you used to be a Boston music critic.
Yes.
Your book, World Enough, actually focuses on the Boston club scene. I myself am a longtime veteran of the Boston club scene, so maybe you and I might catch a show or something. Maybe you and I will.
I knew that there was some overlap there.
Yeah.
Well, I'll be honest. On Saturday night, after I'm going to be at the book party, of course, but probably later than that, I'm probably going to sneak out and go see Bob Mould at the Paradise.
Ah, there you go. What is your favorite club to go to? What's your top?
Wow. Some of my favorites are long gone. I mean, I was a fan of the Rat back in the day. I was a Rat girl. And we're going to be near the site of the long departed channel, which was actually kind of a pit in some ways. Mm. Favorite club now. Wow. You know, maybe the Sinclair in Harvard Square. That's a great space.
Yes.
City Winery is having some good bookings, but it doesn't really have, it's not like a restaurant that has music than a club. But they're bringing, I mean, I miss Johnny D's, and, you know,
Johnny D's, rest in peace.
I'm of an age where I can tell you more about the clubs that I miss than the clubs that I love.
Yeah.
But the Sinclair is a lovely space. Once over here in Somerville, is running again, so that's a good space. Yep. You know, places like that. What are some of your favorites?
Oh, I would have to go with, well, you know what? Church was actually one of my favorites. You know,
oh,
rest
yeah,
in peace.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, that one's gone too.
Yeah.
The restaurant's still there, but the venue is gone.
Yeah.
That was actually my first introduction to the Boston music scene was going to shows at church because I first lived in the city on Queensbury Street.
Oh, perfect.
Which was down the street from where church used to be. And
yeah.
So I would just go right down there, go to shows. It was great because they had some amazing acts, great people there. The food was awesome. Parking. They had free parking.
Yeah.
That was great. That's really rare.
Yeah.
But in terms of clubs that are still around, Sinclair, when you go on that second level and see the whole sea of people, oh, my God, it is breathtaking.
Yeah, that's great for people like me who maybe aren't quite up to being in the scrum anymore.
Yeah.
But you can get up there and you can actually see. And the sound's good, too.
Yeah, it sounds great, too. I haven't been there yet, but I really want to check out Sonia, which is the former TT the Bears place.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I was a big TT's fan.
Oh, I love TT's.
I haven't been back, yeah.
My favorite shows were there. Let's see. Oh, All Asia. Okay. I know
yeah.
people might give some flack about that, but All Asia was a great place to go to. I actually used to book shows there and a few other venues. And what I liked about the All Asia was it was a great place to get your start. If you were
yeah.
a brand new band and you were like new to the scene, they would put you on stage. They didn't you know say a lot about draw and whatnot. Get like 100 people in here. You go. You can bring two people. You can still come back.
Well, you know, that's I don't know if you had a chance to read My World enough, but that's one of the features, I think, of the Boston scene is because we've always had so many musicians and so many fairly young people or young at heart people. We've always been really good about maximizing alternative spaces because All Asia, I believe, was basically a restaurant. And you have places like that. You've got a bunch of the Irish pubs that weren't set up for music that now have music like Sally O'Brien's, The Plow. And there are just, if you keep your ears open, there's usually a buzz about some place where some person has decided, the owner's decided, oh, on Tuesday night, I'll let this kid bring bands in on Thursday nights. And what the hell, we'll do it all ages on Saturday afternoon because there's no traffic after lunch anyway. And that's what keeps the Boston scene going. I don't know if you had a chance to read World Up, but that's what I tried to capture was the community. With its pluses and its minuses, because it is sort of a dark book.
Yeah.
but the community that is centered around, there's just something unifying and creative that brings people together. Sometimes it enables their worst instincts, but it does bring people together.
It really does. Yeah. I mean, I have made so many friends from going to shows and people that I met there. Doing the show because the show originally started as a spotlight for the local music scene, and it kind of like grew over the years. But that's
yeah.
how it kind of kicked off because I had a number of friends who were in bands that couldn't really get themselves out there in terms of the media. So I thought, you know what, I'm the media. I work in the media. I love doing radio. So you know what, I'm going to do a show dedicated to the local arts. And
yeah,
that was like that was like 9 years ago. Still doing today. So. Gotta be doing something right.
Yeah, yeah. No, that's what made the scene great. Maybe still does.
Yeah, I think it's still a very strong scene. Some people say, "Oh, it's not what it used to be," and it's changed certainly. But I don't think that there's a real lack of talent. I think the talent's very strong. We're kind of blessed to have schools like Berkeley and Northeastern that really produce like strong musicians. So I think it's a great scene. I think there's a lot to offer, and it's easy to kind of look on the negative side of things.
Yeah, it's become more expensive to live here, and so a lot of musicians are now going elsewhere. I mean, it used to be that Boston was cheaper than Brooklyn. Now it's not. So a lot of musicians, young musicians, move. Mm-hmm. You know, Brooklyn, North Carolina, Texas. I feel like a lot of people I love and respect have moved just for the reality of making a living as a musician. But
sure. And
yeah.
You know, we have I think a lot of good like neighboring cities too that also have a strong scene. You have of course. Providence
has a great scene. Yeah.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
AS 220. News Cafe. The Met. So many others. So that's a great one. I think actually New Hampshire Their scene isn't quite as good as Boston, but I think they've got a decent like music scene too. Manchester, Nashua, those areas. You've definitely got some options, and we're also seeing it spread outside because we're seeing people open venues in some of the smaller towns that are near Boston.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then there's Salem. I mean, Salem's becoming really big.
Yeah. That's true. And I mean, I like to think that there's some kind of relationship between the music scene and the writing scene. I mean, so many of us are in both. And a lot of the forces that, you know, that drive one, drive the other. And one of the nice things about the music scene is, well, writing is such a solitary occupation, which is one of the reasons events like BossCon are so great. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, we basically live in our little caves and we come out blinking like mole people
to socialize actually.
With others.
I hear that a lot.
Well,
it's like all of a sudden, oh, there's, you know, sunlight and people and I'm going to go experience those things.
I'm going to put on clean clothes for the first time since fall.
Oh, my. Well, you know, Klee, you've got certainly a lot to be talking about at this year's BossCon, of course. You have so many titles. I will not try to name them all because that will actually take up the remainder of this time here. But to kind of like narrow it down for everyone, so you have your new novel, World Enough.
World Enough is not the newest, actually.
Oh, okay.
My newest, World Enough is my rock and roll noir. But okay. In terms of BossCon, I'm actually sort of focusing more on the books that have more speculative fiction, that are more alternative reality. I've got sort of, and for that, I'd like to focus on sort of two strands. I have my brand new book, A Spell of Murder, is actually sort of. I like to think it's fun. It's whimsical. It's a lighter. It's a mystery, but it's a woman who lives, young woman who lives in Cambridge, and for various reasons she has decided to study witchcraft. But the joke's on her because the truth is it's her three cats that are the witches.
Yes, I actually started reading that, and I was like, cats, witchcraft.
Yep,
this is great. You know, and that's actually the.
It seems obvious, doesn't it?
It's a wonderful combination, and it's actually the theme of a lot of your books. All your books actually do involve cats or animals. You have the Blackie and Care mystery series.
That's much darker. That's the sort of speculative fiction set in a ruined dystopian city that may bear some resemblance to Boston after the apocalypse. And that's narrated by the black cat, a feral black cat, who, for various reasons, which become clear as you read, feels responsibility toward this homeless teen Care who he takes care of.
I get it. I want to ask you, you know, animals being in so many of your books, how did that all come about?
Wow, how not?
There is that too, yeah.
We are all animals, Max. We are all animals. But beyond that, I like to think that it's probably just me channeling being a youngest child and a youngest child from a in some ways unhappy household. In that I related to my pets much more strongly than I related to any people. And, you know, certainly growing up with, you know, C.S. Lewis, you know, the Narnia books and Tolkien, et cetera, I think I just always felt more of a kinship with animals. And so it makes sense that animals being, you know, the smaller and less listened to creatures become my protagonists. Mm. You know, and it just seems natural to me to write them.
Okay. I just started reading A Spell of Murder, and you know, you have these the three cats, and they have a very like disparate personalities. But
I should hope so.
Yeah, definitely. How do you craft like the characters for these animals that you obviously, you know, you can't talk to, you can't like listen to them? So like, how do you kind of like decide how they're going to be and how they're going to act?
Well, I would argue with you. You can talk to them, but more important is you can listen to them. You write animals by observing them, and it's, you know, if you spend any time with animals, and, you know, and I've written nonfiction about animals as well. You see how they communicate and how they react. You know, how they communicate with each other, how they try to communicate with us. how they react to the world. And it's a lot of it is nonverbal, of necessity nonverbal. I make it verbal in my books. But it's very clear. I mean, you know, if you look at a cat that's lashing a tail, you know what it's thinking. If it puts its ears back, you know what it's thinking. And, you know, the opposite with a dog. If a dog wags its tail, you know what it is thinking. So I think it just comes from observation. And as to their distinct personalities, well, again, if you spend any time with animals, you know that they have distinctive personalities. Mm. As to how my fictional animals come to me, you know, it's how does any character come to any writer? You know, maybe there's something you see on the street, and suddenly it becomes a story in your book. Like it was my Dulcie Schwartz series, which features a young woman who's studying the Gothic literature of the late 17th century, and she thinks of herself as quite a serious scholar until, of course, her own life becomes a little gothic and she starts seeing ghosts. And the primary ghost that she sees is the ghost of her late great cat. And that came about because it was a little while after I had lost, I had put to sleep my beloved cat Cyrus. I was walking down the street, I was late for an appointment, and I saw a cat, and he was a long-haired gray cat. He was a shelter cat. But he looked like a Norwegian forest cat, and I was walking down the street, and I saw a cat who looked just like him. He had very distinctive markings sitting on a stoop, and I saw that cat. I thought, oh, my God. But I was late for an appointment, so I kept going. And I searched and searched the neighborhood afterward. I could never see that cat again. And so, of course, I thought, well, what if Cyrus came back to me? And then it's, well, what if Cyrus came back to warn me of something? And so the Dulcie Schwartz series starts with Dulcie coming home and seeing her late great cat sitting on the stoop, and the cat says to her, "Don't go inside." And she goes inside and finds that her roommate has been murdered. Hmm. And that's how it starts.
man, roommates are tough to find.
Well, but it comes from listening to animals and observing them. Sure. Basically, we writers are watchers and we're eavesdroppers. Mm-hmm. And and we listen to everything. There's a T-shirt that some of my friends have that says, "Don't piss me off, or I'll kill you in my next novel."
Yes.
And and there's a lot of truth to that. We're gathering little tidbits to use in our books.
That's something I hear a lot is don't piss off a writer, or they will kill you in the book, and don't piss off a musician, or they're gonna write a really bad song about you.
Yeah, exactly. Just look at Taylor Swift.
Exactly. You know, break a musician's heart at your own peril, because then you become part of the song. I want to add back up a bit to Our World Enough, of course. As we mentioned, this takes place in the Boston music scene.
Yeah.
When you were like writing this, did you incorporate some of your own experiences? Did things that you had seen, shows you've been to, did they become kind of like a part of the book?
That's a difficult question, because partly it's the whole gestalt of the scene that I tried to capture. And by the way, one of the nice things, World Enough, my publisher is British, so the book was expensive, but it's finally coming out in a trade paperback this spring. So I think people can pre-order it now at a more reasonable price. So that's really nice. And I think I have the link on my website, et cetera. I thought that I made up a lot of things, but made them up in the context of knowing the scene so well, because, I spent so many years there that I didn't want to write anything that felt like it couldn't happen. So there were elements of truth, but then funny things happened. Like, I did a bunch of readings when World Enough first came out, and I talked about a scene that I'd written, in which, as at least was typical back in the day, the band wasn't being paid, but they could drink as much as they could drink. They were being paid in free beer. And with the result that the drummer gets so drunk that during the first song, he vomits and falls off his stool and they can't play. And I said, I made that up. And several people at my reading objected and said, "Oh no, we remember when that happened at Chet's Last Call or at Johnny D's," or, So some things that I think I made up, maybe they were in my memory. That said, And of course, everybody thinks that they recognize who the bands were. Like, there's the one band that should have been famous and didn't quite make it. And some people go, oh, that's the Del Fuegos. That's the Prime Movers. That's this. I used real detail, but none of the actual events are, to my knowledge, true. You know, and I say that in part because there are two suspicious deaths which may or may not be linked. You know, while I was writing it, Whitey Bulger, this is a couple goes back a couple of years, Whitey Bulger was arrested. Mm-hmm. And a lot came out. The former manager of the channel, his body was found. That's what it was. And so a lot came out about how the channel may or may not have been used for laundering money, because we thought of the channel as this cavernous hangout that, you know, where bands could play and the bouncers tended to beat up on the underage kids. But in truth, it was a cash-centered business on the edge of South Boston at a time when the South Boston mob was very active. So, you know, I was thinking, well, this is feasible. And then we find out that the manager of the channel had been executed mob style and his body buried beneath what became a parking lot. So, you know, did I invent that or was that true?
Hmm.
Yeah.
You'll have to read the book, find out.
Yeah. Yeah. But I had that story actually for, you know, for years before this came out. So, I like to think that it was, to some extent, it was just that I was picking up signs of what was all around us all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Another point of interest for me about World Enough, I started writing World Enough actually in the 80s.
Really?
And I just could never finish it. And I finally went back to it a couple of years ago and started rewriting it. And I realized that I had been trying to write basically a love story to the scene, because the scene was my alternative, you know, home. It was my family. Whereas in truth, what I was writing was about, the selective blindness of nostalgia and how we don't see what we don't want to see, you know, especially when we need to have a community and when we need to have an alternative family and we need things for things to be a certain way, you know, then maybe, you know, we turn a blind eye to what's right in front of us. And that's important for the main character in World Enough. And it's maybe it's an important part of finally coming to terms with your memories and with growing up.
When it comes to writing other mysteries, do you like applaud like every single point as it goes along, or do you kind of just let the story sort of go and see where it kind of takes you?
Oh, I'm much more. You're asking if I am what we call a plotter or a pantser.
Oh, as I've heard that
the
term,
pants.
Yeah,
yeah. I'm much more a pantser. I like to be surprised, and I think that some people can do it marvelously, but I feel like if I plot out a story from A to Z, it will be predictable because I predict it, and I'd much rather see where the characters take me. The downside of that is I have to do a lot more revision. I'm now revising the second Wolfcats mystery to follow up on A Spell of Murder. And, it's like cracking a whip. The tail of the whip is very far away from where the handle is. And so I'm going to go through this and go, no. This, you know, isn't true. She 2 pages ago, she said something else entirely. So it takes a lot more revision. But to me, it's a lot more fun, and at least in my case, I think it makes for more interesting books because I can discover things. Like in World Enough, have you finished it? I don't know if you finished it, but there's a revelation right on the very last pages, and I didn't realize that till I was writing it. And I was like, oh my God! And that was wonderful for me, and I hope it'll be wonderful for the reader too. It's something that that my protagonist realizes, you know, and right when it's too late to do anything about it, but knowledge is always power, right?
It definitely is.
Yeah.
Have you ever had to totally just like restart a book because in the process of revising you realize, you know what, this is actually better, this should be changed, that's not gonna work?
Yes.
Really? Oh no.
yeah the book that I'm in now, it's like I at one point I realized I you know somebody else died. And I was like, no, it's better if he doesn't die, because I want him to come back, and then he's just in a coma for a while, and then he's going to come up and say something. And I also realized that I wanted to, well, you know, the Chekhovian theory of if you show a handgun in the first act, it should go off by the third. If you have poison, if you have a fake poisoning in the first act, you should have a real poisoning by the third, right? I'm giving you that because I'm hoping that in a year when this book is out, no one will remember that.
Exactly.
But yes, and World Enough, I really totally revised. Yeah. I just totally rewrote that book. And, you know, I set it aside for more than a decade. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
When the time came to actually pick it up again, did you think, like, oh, wow, this is, you know... this is, like, no good? I mean, because I know that, like, writers develop their skills over time, of course, and what you wrote 20 years ago probably won't be the same as what you can write now. So did you sort of see the mistakes that the younger you made?
Well, I trashed everything except the opening scene I rewrote.
Well, there we go, then. I guess that answers my question.
Yeah. But, you know, it was nice to have that opening scene. That was a great prompt.
Sure. You know, I want to talk a little more about, you know, pets as characters, animals as characters. Do you think that, in your experience, does having animals as characters versus people as characters, does that like, dramatically change the story?
The big misconception is that animal mysteries are all cutesy, and there really are a range of them, and I try to write that range. You know, from the darkest, the Blackie and Care, to the lightest, like A Spell of Murder.
Okay, yeah. When I first picked up your books, I thought, animals and mysteries. Okay, let's, you know, see what, like, comes of this. Because I think I had that same misconception, like, that this is going to be very kind of cutesy. It's going to be very kind of, you know, it is kind of cute. It's a little whimsical. But my thing, like, was like, okay, maybe this will be some kind of, like, Disney-esque kind of story, you know?
No, yeah.
Definitely not. I'm realizing my mistake. I am falling on that sword, and I was wrong.
Well, thank you. And if A Spell of Murder is too light for you, please try The Ninth Life, because I think you'll find that it is much darker. And actually, one of the nice things, my publisher, an ebook omnibus of the first two of the Blackie and Care mysteries. It's two in one for some kind of special price, you know, on Amazon, places like that. The third book is still a standalone and, you know, priced accordingly. But if people want to try those first two books, so that's nice. Yeah. You know, that's my publisher. That's totally out of my control, but it was nice that they did that. So I'm happy.
Definitely. Now, given how much you've written here, I'm curious, are you like a full-time author? Is this like your full-time job?
Well, I have not had a full-time job for many years. I used to work at the Boston Globe, but I still do a fair amount of freelancing because writing books I am what is politely called a mid-level author, which means I sell enough so that publishers keep publishing me. But you know, I'm not on any bestseller list, so I still do I write book reviews for the Boston Globe, and I do some professional editing. Just to round out the income, shall we say?
I get you. Because one of the things I hear a lot is that making a career as a writer is extremely difficult to do, and you know, some people can do it, some people don't. For some folks, it's always a thing they do kind of like on the side. But where it's kind of like maybe half the career for you, you know, like it is like part of like what you do. How do you make it something that can be a little more sustainable? Like, what's your advice on that front?
It's hard. You have to write regularly. You know, I'm lucky in that my main area, mysteries, publishers like series. And so I have deadlines. While it is hard to be creative on a deadline, it does make you produce. So I write every day. I think that's important. I think that's important whether or not, you know, you're looking at your income or not. If you're a writer, you know, you're not a writer if you just lounge around thinking about the books you would write. You're a writer if you write. So that means, you know, apply butt to seat and do it. But I think that the reality is that most of us do have to do something to supplement our incomes. I have a friend who is a literary novelist who is a regular New York Times bestseller, and she teaches. Most of us do something on the side. But you're a writer if you write. And if you want to, make a career out of it, take your craft seriously, practice it, write, you know, if you have to have a full-time job, set aside a regular time. If you can, write every day. But, you know, it is the book that you want to write will always be better than the book that you're writing, because reality never measures up to, you know, what you fantasize it will be. But to be a writer, you just have to, you know, write badly, write sloppily, write first drafts that you would never let anyone see. Just get it done and make yourself do it on some kind of regular basis. I mean, for me, I tend to, right now I'm revising, so that's a different time. But when I am writing, I give myself a daily word count that I have to hit. You know, and I work Monday through Friday because I can now, because I'm not in an office. You know, I'll say, okay, I have to do 1,500 words or something like that. Sometimes I do more, but I don't leave until I've at least hit that.
Okay. Were there ever like moments in your career where you thought, okay, this is going nowhere, I'm going to stop doing it, no one cares?
Yes. Next question. No. Often.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm going to get a job. This is crazy. Yeah. Starbucks is hiring.
Oh boy.
Yeah.
What then? In that case, what keeps you going?
Well, you know, at most that lasts for a day, and at this point my husband knows better than to say anything. And usually what happens, and in fact what happened the most recent time that happened, was I then start thinking of a story I want to write. And it's like, you know, what often happens is I have that feeling of, I'm done, I've just put out so much, I've got nothing back, you know, the money's crap, you know, the readers are skeptical at best. I just can't do this anymore, and you know, I'm gonna quit, and you know, I've just emptied myself out. And then it's like there's a spring somewhere and it comes back. And for me, usually what happens is what happened, this was just like, you know, a couple of weeks ago, where I just got this little like tickle, and it was like, what if this character, it's a character from a manuscript the manuscript is making the rounds now. And I was thinking it was a standalone. And I was like, well, this character could face this kind of problem, and this would really go against her particular weaknesses. So that might be interesting. And, you know, before I had I'd thought about it, I had a typed page of single space notes. So it's like, okay, I'll quit. Let me just write this one first. And so now I've had to put those notes aside, because now I'm revising the second Witch Cats book, which I think is going to be called An Incantation of Cats.
But, I like that incantation.
Thank you.
Because I am like a longtime cat lover. I've had cats growing up. And what you were saying earlier about them having their own disparate personalities, I mean, that's spot on, because my cats have been... I've had cats who are very, like, mellow and chill. I've had cats who are borderline psychotic. I've had cats who are love to get, like, in your face. I've had cats who don't want anything to do with you unless you're feeding them. So
yeah.
It's certainly ranged for me. Like I had one cat. She was super friendly. Best cat you could ever ask for. And I had one who was like, oh, it's you. Feed me and take off.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, they're as individual as people. Definitely. They just communicate in different ways.
Definitely, definitely. Now, is there any of your series that has been like more like popular?
Wow. Well, probably, and to some extent, this is a function of price, because they've got a domestic publisher. My Prue Marlowe Pet Noirs, of which there are now 7 books. The latest is Fear on Four Paws, which features sort of my bad girl, hard drinking animal psychic. And her even tougher tabby, she can hear what animals are thinking, but what she hears is them thinking about their own concerns. It's not like they talk to her for the most part.
Oh, okay.
You know, they're concerned with, you know, eating and mating and safety and nesting. Except for her, she has a tabby she lives with who, you know, is very sarcastic. So that's the Prue Marlowe Pet Noir series, and that's been probably the most successful. But partly that's because it's a domestic publisher, so the books are the least expensive.
I see.
A Spell of Murder is actually, you know, off to a great start. So I'm hoping, I've got great hopes for that. So that's, you know, Clara is the Calico, mm-hmm. who's the star of that, and her sisters Harriet and Laurel.
Yeah, I love those three. They're awesome. The way they're like bickering like back and forth, and I love like the opening of the book where it's like,
well, they're sisters, yeah.
Yeah, of course, yeah, siblings. They're always gonna fight. I have a brother.
And if
a lot.
And if you know, and if you have more than one cat, then you know, it's like sometimes they'll be grooming each other, and then there'll be a hiss, and somebody will be batting somebody else in the ears, and it's like, well, what are they thinking?
Yeah.
You know, what's going on there?
Pick one.
Yeah.
Come on.
Yeah.
Oh my God. Well, Clea, it's been awesome talking to you. I really appreciate this, and I definitely look forward to meeting you face to face at Bosco.
Yes. And if people you see me, you come up to me and say hi. I mean, yes. I'm, you know, the big secret about authors is we're all sort of shy. So if you come up and say hi, we will talk to you until you're sick of us. But, you know, and you can just walk away then, and we'll understand that too.
Okay.
So please come up and say hi. Oh, and if anyone wants to see, I do have my BossCon schedule up on my website, which mm-hmm. is cleasimon.com. So, you know, if you're looking for me in particular, I'm on – bunch of panels, and I'll be at the book party Saturday night. I'm moderating a couple of panels too, which I'm very psyched about. So please come up and say hi and just say I heard you on Max's show.
Excellent, Clea, thanks so much, and I'll be talking soon. Guest is actually going to be back this year for his second time. So he liked it so much, he's back again. I am talking to Atlanta-based author, theologian, philosopher, and poet, Gerald Coleman. And Gerald, man, welcome to the show.
Hey, Max. Thank you. Thank you, man. I'm so glad to be on the show and looking forward to it.
All right, man. All right. Now, you have a very lengthy resume, sir. If I think if I tried to read the entire thing, we would be here for the next couple hours. But the one thing I really want to ask you about, now, I know that your education included a lot of time in theology, and you're also like a science fiction writer as well. I was really wondering, how did those two merge at all? How do those two worlds connect?
Oh, wow. Yeah, that's an interesting question. I guess for me that the connection is, and actually we talked about this last year at another convention that I was at, where we talked about to what degree or to what extent those things that that people have kind of specialties in, how much they kind of influence the writing, and what are the dangers in maybe that being sometimes too much. And so there's certainly a kind of a balance that you have to strike. But for me, I guess both of those things kind of naturally intertwined in my life from a very early age. I started reading comics as a kid, and from there, for example, Scholastic, I was introduced to the kind of earliest speculative fiction that I was reading in elementary school. I don't know if you know the Rats of Nim.
Stories. I love that story. I actually found an original pressing of the book.
Oh wow!
It was about to be destroyed at one of those. I don't say destroyed. More like repurposed for one of those like book art kind of things where you take like old books, you turn them into like origami and stuff. Can I have that? They said sure. I was like, thank you very much. So that is one of my prize collections. Actually, as a kid, I watched the movie The Secret of Nim, which is based on that book. Man, Don Bluth. Oh God, he's got quite the imagination.
Yeah, so that was kind of the part of my earliest kind of introduction to speculative fiction, and then I went and obviously as I grew, I kind of started branching out into reading a lot of that stuff. And at the same time, I was being raised in a community of faith. My mom was a single mom, and she kept my brother and I in church. And so for me, those two kind of strings kind of wove themselves into who I was kind of very naturally on up through university. And so by the time I'm writing science fiction and fantasy, and really if you're reading a particularly epic fantasy, there's generally a strain of theology running through some of it, depending upon which author you're talking about. And always there's some deism in there, and other ways in which kind of when you're world building, some of the questions that you have to ask about the world in which your story takes place kind of lends itself to the kind of work that I did in that area. So, it became a very natural extension of what I was doing as a science fiction and fantasy writer.
Hmm. I've seen that a lot, actually. Some writers will go so far to create an entire religion to kind of fit in their world. They'll create like gods and goddesses and faiths, and even like the things that the characters say. You know, like we would say like, "Oh my God," they would say something else. They would kind of be tied to that faith.
Right.
I think that pops into mind first would be Conan. You know, because in a lot of cases. I'm probably leaning more towards the animated series and less of the comic, but his whole thing was a battle to stop a god from coming into the world and destroying it.
Right. Right. You know, you get those bicrombs,
thrown in. Thank you for doing that.
Throughout. And really his entire kind of, his entire philosophy of life was based on his understanding of, of Crom as this god who really kind of gave you some basic tools. You know, he gave you your life, he gave you your strength, he gave you steel, and the rest of it was up to you. And so there was this kind of and sometimes that would become an antagonistic kind of relationship for him by cursing Crom, because Crom, you know, it's like he's not even really involved. It's like, you know, so I can kind of blame you for some of this. But that was a certain structure for that. And take, for example, the Wheel of Time, Robert Jordan. Mm-hmm. There's an entire mythos woven into that, reincarnation and the Wheel of Time and how all of that plays out. Those are a couple of examples of how you see that kind of throughout the genre.
Oh, yeah, definitely, definitely. You know, going back a bit to Conan, in fact, you mentioned how that can be a sometimes antagonistic relationship. I remember one line from the movies with Schwarzenegger where he, like, asks, Crom to give him victory. And then he says, but if you can't do this, then to hell with you.
Right.
It's like, right. That's a strong faith there, Conan.
Right, right. Yeah. It was a very, for him, the writer creates a very kind of a very hands-off deity, but he still manages to kind of work that into his world building, so that you can see how that affects and influences his character's relationship to the world around him. So it's a thing that runs through a lot of, and I say fantasy because a lot of times fantasy has this really kind of intensive world building, and so those are often some of the questions that as an author you have to ask yourself, how much of that you're going to kind of entertain in the particular world building in the setting that you're trying to set.
Okay, Let's talk about the world of your books, because I know that you have your own epic fantasy novel saga. Yeah, the Three Gifts. You have parts one, two out. When it came to building your worlds, how long did you spend like doing that before you actually sat down and wrote the books? Because I've heard that some folks will take like 2 years just putting all the pieces together.
Yeah, I guess for me the interesting thing is I kind of started a story that I thought I was going to write when I was at university, but then grad school and other things got in the way, and I really didn't have time to kind of sit down and do the writing that I wanted to do. So by the time I circled back and actually started writing the first book, the story had changed a great deal. And just based on my own experiences and kind of the things that I had read and the story that I had decided that I wanted to tell. But I'd been thinking about it bit by bit over the years. And so, you know, there was some of that happening, jotting down little notes and ideas. But when I finally sat down to start writing, I guess for me, what was important was I knew where I wanted to start the story, and I knew what the ending was. I kind of like Robert Jordan in that way. He said he had written the last scene, you know, from the very beginning, so he kind of knew. So, I have that same kind of process. So I know where the story, where I have to get to eventually in the story, because I know how it's going to end. And then for me, it was, and knowing where it was starting, and then kind of knowing what the kind of underlying purpose for the entire story for me was, then I was able to just kind of sit down and start writing. And so as I began to write, after a few chapters, I got to a point where I said, okay, wait a minute, I need to do some world building here, by which I meant I needed to create a map. I was starting to write this story and inputting, you know, places in this world, and I said, wait a minute, let me actually create the map of the world so that I know where all of this stuff is, where things are taking place, and I can begin to map that out. So one of the first things I did was to create a map of the world, mm-hmm. which you know you can see in the first at the beginning of both the books. And then from there, it was a question of, as I was writing chapter by chapter, then I would begin to flesh out the world based on what was going on and do my world building from that perspective. So for me, it was a world building is a work in progress. Now that I'm, you know, working on book three, I have this extensive world kind of fleshed out, but it wasn't that way from the very beginning. Even though I kind of had a bird's eye view of what I wanted to accomplish, the kind of more kind of minute little interesting pieces that as a fantasy reader myself, I enjoy experiencing when I read in other stuff, that stuff I built in as the story progressed and so that I could flesh it out. Cause I've been reading fantasy, for 35 years. So I'm a fan of the genre. So I know what I like and what I enjoy. And I think I have enough of a grasp on it to know what the majority of folks who love to read in the genre, you know, like about those stories. So, you know, I have had an ability to kind of, okay, at this stage, this is what I need to kind of flesh out in the world building so that I can move forward with the story.
Okay. All right. And the story certainly gets off to a very dark start. You have like the shadows rolling in, creatures appearing from like out of nowhere, people like vanishing. Safe to say that the opening round, things are not really looking too good for the world.
Yeah, you have to kind of make sure that there are real stakes, you know, in the mm-hmm. story. And for me, it's always the stories that I've always enjoyed were the stories that the heroes have a real battle on their hands, and there are real consequences to of what's going on in the story. And but let me also say this. I was just dawned on me as we were talking about the process in the previous kind of part of this discussion. You know, I always want to say to folks, write how you write, because I know there's some folks who think there's this kind of authoritative way that people have to approach the process. And while I've kind of just explained a little bit of what my process is, that doesn't necessarily have to be anybody else's process, because there are some people who really enjoy the kind of the sitting down and really, like you said, take 2 or 3 years to really kind of create the tapestry of the world that they're going to, that this story is going to take place in. And then they sit down and begin to write the actual story. And if that works for them, that's great. You know, I think everybody ought to write in a way that kind of best creates for them the best possible experience so that they can do their best work. And so I always like to say that when questions of process come up, to say that everybody has a different kind of process, and I don't think one process is better than the other. I think people just have to write in a way that gets them in a place where they can do their best writing. but yeah, I guess for me, I've also been influenced by stuff like Glenn Cook and the Black Company. Obviously, I mentioned the Wheel of Time, the Faded Sun series by C.J. Cherry. I like a lot of stuff that has kind of, and I guess that's why I'm writing in epic fantasy, because I like the stuff where it has that kind of really kind of big, there's a big bad out there, and the heroes have to figure out what's going on and then figure out how you stop it. And so for me, that was the way to approach that. But now again, people have approached their stories differently. But that's how I felt like I wanted to start the Three Gifts. So it's how When Night Falls starts off.
I agree with you there too. You know, like there really is no like manual to writing. There's no like one way that works better for others. You know, some folks will be what they call planners. Other people will be what they call pantsers, where they just right. where they just sort of fly off and they'll see what happens. So my question to you, Gerald, is which are you? Do you like plan everything out? Do you like map out every single step, or you just kind of just go off and see where the story takes you?
I guess I'm a little bit of both. I I know some people whose writing process is that they like to write out the entire story and then go back and write the whole. If the story is 300 pages long, then that's what they write out the whole story and get it out. And then they go back and start from their editing process from the beginning. And then so they go back to page one and then start editing. And then they go back and edit again and then go back and edit a third or a fourth time and kind of, you know, fashion the story that way. And I'm a little different. I like to, when I get to the end, I like to be finished. So for me, I'll write a chapter and then I'll edit that chapter and I'll hammer on it, fine tune it, so that when I finish that chapter and put it away, it's done. And I don't ever have to go back to it. And that's just my particular process. And so for me, there is a bit of planning in that, as I said earlier, I know how the entire story is going to end. So then the next step when I sit down to write is to figure out where does this particular book in that story end. So when I sat down to write book one, I said, okay, by the time I finish book one, I need to get to this place in the story. And I did the same thing with book two. By the time I get to the end of this book, I need to be this place in the story so that I can, you know, get to the final place at the end of the series. And so I do the same thing inside the book, chapter by chapter. So as I start a chapter, I say, okay, now this is where I need to get to by the end of this chapter. So that's the level of kind of planning that I'll do. But then I start writing, and as a lot of writers would tell you, once you really kind of develop your world and then develop your characters to the point where you have a really firm grasp on who they are, what their voice is, and what their place is in the story, a lot of times they will begin to talk to you and say, hey, this is where I want the story to go, where you may have planned for the story to head in one direction and your characters will kind of intervene and say, no, the story needs to go this way. So as much as there is some planning that takes place while I'm writing, I'm also open to the possibility of where the story itself kind of wants to go. And the more you write, the more you're able to kind of parse that out and figure out when that's a good idea to follow that and see where it leads, and when you figure out, well, yeah, that was a good thought, but that was just a thought experiment. That's not really where the story needs to go. But there's a lot of that. So for me, it's a bit of both. I do some planning and have kind of an outline structure, but then I'm the kind that I really do like to see as I'm writing and let inspiration take over and see where the story leads.
Have you ever had the story like take you down a path that you weren't really planning on? Have you ever like had, you know, you're just writing and writing and writing and then all of a sudden you realize, hey, wait a minute, this is not at all how I thought this was like going to happen?
Right. Yeah, that happens. Because my story is an epic fantasy, there's obviously the main protagonist, but then there are subplots. And there's subplots with other characters involved. And sometimes I will have a thought about where I think this subplot is tied into the story and how it should go. But then as you start to write it, a whole other thing starts to happen. And you really kind of get to the point where you feel like you have to learn how to trust what of that is good and what of that is just an experiment that you kind of have to let go and move on. But that happens, definitely.
Now, as you mentioned earlier, this is going to be your second year at Boscone. I'm curious as to how you first became aware of Boscone and like what made you want to be a part of it.
Wow. I guess for me, I discovered it because one of the members of the town committee who runs it, Aaron Underwood, who's very interested in creating an environment that is inclusive, is in the habit of kind of looking into the writing community and trying to find folks who would be good artists to come and be a part of the of the convention, and one of my good friends is also an author, Milton Davis, had gone to a previous Boscone, so that's how I had initially heard about it. And we have a group called the State of Black Science Fiction on Facebook. It has about 16,000 members, and it's a place where we kind of use as a community for those of us who are creators or writers or people who are interested, just basically interested in the genre. And that's one of the places that I think some people who are trying to find creators and artists and authors can go and find those persons. And so she sent me an invitation. And because I had heard about it prior, and I knew Milton had gone, I reached out to him to ask his opinion of the convention and whether it was something that he enjoyed and thought was kind of a viable place to be. Because sometimes you, as a writer of color, you have to be careful where you go, because sometimes it's not always a welcoming environment. And so you kind of have to really do your due diligence to make sure you're not going into a place that is not going to be conducive to you as a creator and a writer. But Milton gave it the thumbs up. And so because they reached out to me and I did some due diligence and checked it out and thought it'd be a good experience. And so that's why I agreed to go last year. And it turned out to be a great experience, a very welcoming environment. And I had a good time. So I decided, hey, let me put this one on the list as one of the places that I'd like to circle back to.
You know, bringing up the subject, you mentioned that you really want to make sure you kind of like look into an area, look into a convention to make sure it's going to be a good place to be at. I also want to talk to you a bit about your thoughts on I guess the state of the genres of science fiction and fantasy, if they're getting, I guess, equal representation among among like all people, because this is the thing that came up last year when I was talking to a couple other authors. They feel like it's getting better. Like people of a different like backgrounds are getting basically invited to, you know, be like a part of these events. But I wanted to get like your thoughts on that. Do you feel like there's a good amount of inclusiveness?
You know, I think people are starting to become aware that there needs to be some work in that area, and I think there are some people out there who are really trying to make that happen, and I certainly think it needs to happen, and that there's still a lot of work to be done. I think there was trying to remember the name of it, but there was a report that came out in 2015 about diversity in publishing, and they went through marketing, editing, publishing, writing, all the various areas in publishing. And talked about the level of diversity, whether it's race or gender, orientation, all these various categories. And what they found out is that, you know, we've got a long way to go. Thankfully, that there are some people who are starting to see that and are really trying to begin the process of working toward making it a lot more inclusive. But that's why, you know, for me, you have to be very careful about what places you accept invitations to, because it's not just enough to invite more diverse authors. You have to make sure that the environment they're coming into is one that's conducive to their, you know, mental and emotional health. I was actually at a convention that I probably won't go back to, because I was on a panel and one of the other guests on the panel was really was like, hey, you know, you don't have any issues. There aren't these problems you're talking about don't really exist. And of course, we had a lively discussion back and forth, because I had to explain to this person that yes, in fact, you know, these things do still exist. Yes, we do have a lot of work yet to do. But that was a more benign interaction. You know, that wasn't one that was, you know, that it could have, in other words, it could have been a lot worse. And there are other places where it has been a lot worse, where you have people who actually engage in harassment and other, you know, behaviors that you want to kind of curtail at events like that. But, you know, it exists and it's still out there, and we do have a lot of work yet to do. And there are some kind of areas where there are folks who see that and either feel threatened by it or have other issues with it. And so it's something that we definitely have to contend with. But it's one of the reasons that for me, Boscone is on my list and kind of continues to be on my list because it creates kind of a welcoming environment that makes you feel like you're welcome in it, and that you know it's your place as well as anybody else's, and you don't have to feel like you're a stranger kind of imposing on folk, which you can. That's a feeling that you can't get at some conventions, because there's this kind of small corner of fandom that feels like that's an imposition or an invasion. That in some sense folks are encroaching on something that belongs to them. So yeah, it's something that we're still working on as a community, and I think hopefully we'll get better at it.
Definitely. The vibe I got, you know, like just talking to folks like last year, is that they definitely feel like there are like some events like Boscone where there is a great deal of inclusion, but still it's like there's still some more work to be done. We're not there, so.
Right. And if you really just are honest about the statistics, you know, as I said, the last one I saw was done industry-wide in 2015. If you're just really honest about the statistics and you're honest about the experiences that people are telling you about, then you have to accept the fact that, yeah, we've made some progress in some areas. Based on some individual people who were willing to recognize the issue and take some steps to really kind of work toward it. But then we still have a lot of issues in other areas that we really have to work on. I mean, there are actually still folks in fandom and in the extended community, including a number of authors, who have really gone on record to say someone like me shouldn't even be writing science fiction and fantasy. Like wow. that somehow or other I don't actually belong in the community, and that my work is that it's a term that, you know, I've even heard the term that some people think it's a derogatory term, SJW, that somehow or other social justice warrior, that somehow that's supposed to be a bad thing. My first question is, I thought all of these folks who we look up to as heroes are social justice warriors, you know, from Superman to Wonder Woman to Batman to all the rest of them. But, you know, so those folks are still out there. They still exist. They're still in some conventions even being given platforms. And those are some of the conventions that, for me, go on my list of places that I'm not interested in attending or being a guest at or participating in. Because if you're going to give those kind of folks a platform to say things like people like me shouldn't even be in the community, then that's obviously you're not creating the kind of environment that's open and welcoming and inclusive. It's something that's still going on. We've got a lot of work to do, and hopefully, cons will try and move in the direction that Boscone has moved in, rather than going in the other direction that some others have.
Exactly. I want to shift topics here for a second, and I'll talk about a group which you helped co-found, which is called the Afrolachian Poets. And I'm curious as to like how this whole as to like how this group got together. And
okay, yeah, great. It was back at, we started back at the University of Kentucky. I was a sophomore. And when I arrived at the University of Kentucky, I mean, I've been writing poetry since I was in high school, but I thought I was an anomaly, you know. And so when I got to the university and I ran into another African-American, his name is Frank X. Walker. He's now, I don't blow Frank's horn too much, but he's, you know, very accomplished now in the field of poetry, award winning. He's Kentucky's poet laureate. And so I ran into him at the university and found out that he was writing poetry too. And I thought, oh, wow, hey, I'm not the only one. And little by little, we we cobbled together a small group of African Americans who were writing poetry and started to create a community for ourselves. And one of the interesting things that happened while we were there is that Lexington had a I'm trying to remember the title of it. It was at the took place at the Opera House. It was something like the best writers in Kentucky, right? And so they brought together all of these writers to read their work at the Opera House. So we went, and I don't know, Frank was there, I was there, and a few other folks, and there wasn't a single African American from Kentucky in the group. And so after it was over, we kind of looked at each other like, okay, so there wasn't a single African American who kind of fit that bill as and could represent that community in Kentucky. And so from that, we kind of really moved forward from just being this kind of loose group of writers to really kind of formalizing it and basically saying if other folk weren't going to call us poets, we'll call ourselves poets and claim our own space. And Frank then coined the term Afrolatian, took Appalachian and added African onto the front. And that word then became a word that represented kind of who we were and what our writing was about. And so from there, we began to do things like workshops, and then we do poetry readings and kind of brought in other younger writers to kind of support them. And it really became just a writing community that was one about empowering and supporting and promoting ourselves and claiming the space under our own feet and calling ourselves what we were and kind of supporting that. And that was 25, almost 30 years ago. We had our 25th anniversary a few years back. And so some of the best writers I know have come out of our little community. We've got award winners, we've got, you know, poet laureates, folk who have published across a number of genres, everything from nonfiction to, speculative fiction. And so it's a community of African-American writers who are engaged in the process of kind of supporting who we are as writers. So it's been a rewarding community.
And speaking of your poetry, I had a chance to check some of your poetry out, and I was really taken with the one backstory. This one centers on the character of Luke Cage, and I am also a big comics fan. And the things you talk about in this poem really, really stuck with me because I never thought of him that way. You know. Talking about how he was born to deflect bullets as a commentary on the plight of black men, that they had to be superheroes just to get through the day. They called him the Power Man because we didn't have any bracelets like handcuffs around his wrists in bright colors. I mean, this is really a character that I don't have a whole lot of experience with. I'm really shy of the TV show. But I'm curious, as to how you saw the character, kind of like what led you to want to like write this poem.
Yeah, it's interesting, Max, because when you look at, and that's why I entitled it Backstory, because when you look at the African-American characters, generally speaking, who were created in that era with probably one exception. And we probably all know who that is, given what's happened in the last year and a half. But for the most part, you had this kind of sense that their backstories often included criminality. You know, they were former criminals, whether actual criminals or falsely accused. They often had to have kind of black in their name, you know, some kind of other nomenclature that kind of separated them from others. They often had really flamboyant and sometimes stereotypical language. But that was an outgrowth of who was doing the creating, because almost exclusively, they were all being created by white creators. Now, Black Panther is the kind of shining exception to the rule. But for the most part, you know, they have that same kind of backstory that Luke Cage had. And so for me, it was because, you know, like you, I read comics from a very young age. And so it was always a kind of, there was always a tension between, yes, wanting to see Black heroes portrayed, but then seeing the problematic ways in which they were portrayed that kind of, you know, caused some internal conflict. So that's what that poem is really about. It's about the inherent and internal conflict of, one, wanting to see that character, wanting to be able to see myself in those characters that be represented, but also can having that unease about kind of the problematic parts of how those characters are created, because they weren't created by African-American creators. So there were often some problematic issues. So, yeah, that's kind of where that poem kind of began as a process.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, one of the other lines that really caught me was partnered with a blonde white boy, married to a brunette, because we need white folks to co-sign our shit.
Yeah.
And I was like, wow, I never thought of that. But yeah. I mean he was been partnered with, you know, Iron Fist his whole like a superhero career, basically. The notion of diversity in comics today, I think we're getting better at that. I think we are seeing more characters of different backgrounds. But what's your take on this? Is this diversity, is it enough? Are we like at a point where comics are becoming properly diverse, or is it more like, okay, occasionally we'll see some like examples of this like pop up, but it's not yet fully interwoven within that kind of community?
Yeah, I think part of the issue, Max, is that we, in particularly in American culture, but also in a broader context, the default character is still white in our imaginations. Like if you start talking about a character before you describe that character, generally what most people are going to begin picturing in their mind is a white male. Because for us, that's we've kind of been inculcated into that idea, meant at a subconscious level, that's the default character. And so beginning and continuing the process of kind of decolonizing our subconscious so that we can approach, characterization in a broader context and a more inclusive way is going to take a lot more work. I mean, we're beginning, as you said, we're beginning that process. You're beginning to see, for example, the new Hulk, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
The new Iron Man, Iron Heart, mm-hmm. you know, Riri Williams, Kamala Khan, the new Miss Marvel. So you're starting to see some of that, and that's a good thing. And I think we have to do a couple of things. We have to continue to do that work, but we also have to continue to do the work of creating opportunities for creators from those communities to be able to write those stories. I think when you do that, then you begin to, not only will you begin to get characters who are race-bended, right? Mm-hmm. But you'll also get original creations that come from the minds and the hearts of people from those communities. And you'll begin to see some newer and exciting stuff that isn't just a repackaging of what's gone on before, but our new creations in and of themselves. So I think we need to be able to multitask. I think it's not an either or. I think it's a both and. And I think we need to continue to do so much more of that. I mean, I think it really has to get to the place where it's unremarkable, right? It's so pervasive that you don't even notice it anymore. Mm-hmm. And I think when we get to that point, when we are 1,000 miles past the first, right? Oh, this is the first Black creator, or this is the first Black character, or this is the first black or person of color to do X, Y, or Z, right? Those are certainly important milestones. But I think we have to get a million miles past that to the point where it's so ubiquitous that you don't even, you know, that it's a given. You don't even really notice it anymore, that a story is so kind of originally authentically inclusive that it's not even something that you would notice, that you would make a point to kind of remark on. I think that's where we have to get. I think when we get there, then we can start to relax a little bit and say we've done the kind of work that we need to do to create that kind of advanced and inclusive community. But as long as it really stands out, right, it means that we haven't reached that point where it's just become a part of the natural landscape of the stories that we want to tell.
You know, this actually made me think about when Kamala Khan was first debuted as the new Ms. Marvel. There was a huge media like surge about it. Everyone's talking about, oh man, you know, look at the new Ms. Marvel. She's Pakistani and she's a girl and et cetera, et cetera. And it's like, well, okay, but maybe, certainly it's worth paying attention to. But maybe that reaction is kind of endemic of the problem that, you know, it shouldn't be a big deal. It shouldn't be, oh my God, it should be, well, yeah, of course, you know. Why wouldn't it be?
Right. It should be, if we can get to the place where introductions of those characters have the same kind of reaction that introduction of a new white character has, right?
Yep.
It's like, you know, if you introduce a new white character, you don't have this big kind of, oh my God, it's a white superhero, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that's just a given, right? So what we tend to do when you introduce a new white character is, what people get excited about are all the other things about that character that are other than that character's race or identity or culture, right? It's about the costume, or it's about the setting, or it's about their powers. It's about everything but who they are in terms of their identity. And I think that's what we have to get. We have to get to the place where when we have so many, and it's such an inclusive community, that when we introduce a new character of color who's a hero, that who they are, their identity doesn't really kind of register at that level. We're more interested in the story. What kind of story are they telling, rather than what character are they using to tell that story? Mm-hmm. But we're still having that reaction because the playing field is so uneven. That when you have a gay Asian character, then all of a sudden there's this huge stop the presses, and let's talk because there aren't enough. So you know, we have that kind of reaction, and so I think we have to get to the place where that level of representation and inclusion is so commonplace that's not where our focus is. I think when we get there, then we'll know we've made some genuine, authentic progress in kind of leveling that field, so that then the question becomes, look at their powers, or look at the context in which the story is being told, or look at the style of the lettering or the coloring or the art. That's where the conversation is, because the playing field is so level. And the representation is so inclusive, and we've come so far that we don't even have to kind of remark on whether the character is Asian or African or Native or Indigenous. That we've done the kind of hard work in creating those opportunities that now is no longer kind of the place where we feel the need to kind of stop the presses and make this big announcement about. I think that's where we're aiming for. I think once we get there, I think we'll be better off.
Well, Gerald, man, it's been great talking to you, and I sincerely look forward to us getting to meet in person and talk to some more over some coffee, because I know.
Right. Hey, Max, look, it's been my pleasure, man, and I appreciate the opportunity to come on and talk to you about all of this stuff. And one of my friends, I mentioned him a bit earlier, a fellow author, Milton, is always laughing because he says that no matter where my story takes place, whether it's in the future or the past, whether it's science fiction or fantasy, coffee's going to show up in the story somewhere.
Oh, yeah, and, of course.
And that's reality.
So. Hey, life. That's life. You know, art imitating life, there's always going to be coffee. There has
to be.
If you ever want to craft a truly dystopian future, do one where the coffee bean does not exist.
Right, exactly.
No one's going to be happy about that.
Right.
We're all going to be tense and jittery.
That's a real dystopian future, yeah.
Exactly. And folks, if you want to learn more about Gerald, to get his books, read his poetry, you can go to GeraldLColeman.co, so no M, .co,